This is Molly Hemingway of The Federalist. Join me, my husband Mark of Real Clear Investigations, Dr. Robert George of Princeton University, Jack Phillips of Masterpiece Cake Shop, and others for the 2021 Making the Case Conference, Friday, July 23rd and Saturday, July 24th at Concordia University, Chicago. You'll find a conference schedule and you can register at issuesetc.org.
I think there are probably, in American publishing, very few media outlets that have the kind of legacy that The Atlantic has had. Not only 164 years of publishing, but also walking a fine line of being able to express a lot of different voices, political and social and otherwise, over that long history. Now, something did change during the Trump era, and something has changed at The Atlantic, and perhaps that is reflected in the fact that it lost $20 million last year. And, well, even its editor-in-chief privately is worrying whether or not it might fold up, whether the owner of The Atlantic might just shutter the publication altogether. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to talk about financial struggles of prestige publishing. Mark Hemingway joins us. He's senior writer for Real Clear Investigations, author of a recent column for The Federalist titled "The Atlantic is Hemorrhaging Money Post-Trump." Mark, welcome back.
Glad to be back.
Talk about The Atlantic's 164-year publishing legacy.
Yeah, there aren't really any more august outlets, as it were, in American media than The Atlantic. I mean, obviously, as you mentioned, it's been around forever, but, you know, people like Ralph Waldo Emerson were involved in the founding of the magazine, and Harriet Beecher Stowe and Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr. They played a big role, in discourse through the Civil War, even. In the 20th century, they published things like Letter to a Birmingham Jail from Martin Luther King Jr. And for the last, I don't know how long, 20 or 30 years in particular, the magazine, it's had some rough periods, but in the last 20 or 30 years, it's sort of been rising to it was like at a low point, and then it sort of rose back up to the point where it was kind of at the apex of American media there for the last 20, 30 years or so. And now obviously it's having financial troubles again. And I don't think it's coincidental that in the last decade or so, it's drifted in a very hard left political direction.
So what is this term prestige publishing? What does that mean?
Well, when I think of that, that's, one thing that's, thrown out there. There are obviously, the big name, longstanding publications that you would think of in this country, The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, The Atlantic. These are publications that have been around for a very long time. They were sort of well-known media properties that, had huge circulations in part because of their, storied history as a publication. And a lot of these publications have, fallen by the wayside. Magazines like GQ and Esquire were once a big part of the discourse in like the 60s and the 70s. And, they're all but non-existent today. I mean, they're on the newsstands, but they're still kind of a zombie version of themselves. Part of that is simply that, if you're a more specific, if you're oriented around things like fashion and lifestyle stuff, all that stuff's on the internet now. So that's been very hard for those kinds of publications to sustain themselves. But for the more sort of political discourse magazines, the prestige publications, as it were, they have still, been occupying a relatively large, space in our discourse in terms of, deciding what people talk about and things like that. But as I mentioned before, I think in the past 5 or 10 years, that control they once had over the discourse has been diminishing quite a bit. Some of that is because of, the aforementioned, internet eating their business model. But a lot of it is simply that they took these sort of big brands that everyone identified with and alienated huge amounts of their audiences by insisting on going in a heavily political direction.
So what do the Atlantic's financials look like as far as we can tell from the recent reporting?
If I'm remembering the article correctly, it said that they had lost $20 million last year, and they were on track to lose $10 million this year. And what was even more astonishing to me is that the CEO of The Atlantic told NBC News that the magazine needed to make $50 million a year to remain profitable, which is just insane to even contemplate is, you know, speaking as someone who's worked at three different magazines, the Atlantic still has a circulation, I think, of something like 750,000 subscribers in some form or another. And yet somehow they're unable to turn a profit off that. I mean, that must just be an incredible amount of bloat and, you know, extravagant salaries and things like that. You know, once upon a time, that kind of bloat in the New York magazine world or the prestige magazine world was sort of a storied part of the industry. But, you know, they had pre-internet, you know, kind of circulations and stuff where they could afford that sort of thing. And it appears that the Atlantic is, you know, still operating as if it's 1995. And, you know, there are millions of people subscribing to magazines. That's just not the case anymore. But even still, you'd think with the number of subscribers they have, 750,000 people is not nothing. You know, you would think that they'd be able to turn a profit off of that, but apparently they can't. But, you know, I'm not sure any of this is really going to matter because, you know, one of the things about being a prestige magazine is that it's worth something to somebody in terms of influence. So in this case, the Atlantic is interesting because unlike, say, Vanity Fair, which is owned by, and the New Yorker, which are owned by Condé Nast, which is a big, you know, publishing behemoth that owns a bunch of magazines, the Atlantic is actually owned by Laureen Powell Jobs, who is the widow of Steve Jobs, who has billions and billions of dollars at her disposal. So even if she hemorrhages tens of millions of dollars a year, there's a good chance that she can afford that. And it might be worth it to her to have the kind of influence in Washington, D.C. that the Atlantic allegedly brings. But over time, it's hard not to imagine that diminishes, that influence isn't, you know, seriously diminishing.
So before we take this break, what do you think happened to the Atlantic's reporting during the Trump era?
Well, I mean, they clearly just snapped. I don't even really know how to say it. They made a huge deal out of the fact that, you know, for the third time, I think, in their 160 plus year history or whatever it is, that they were endorsing a presidential candidate. I mean, they had, you know, endorsed Lincoln previously, but in this case, they were endorsing Hillary Clinton because Donald Trump was such an unacceptable alternative. And the fact that Trump won in spite of, you know, all these influential outlets like the Atlantic throwing all of their credibility down a hole with, you know, half their audience in order to do so was really a testament to sort of their fecklessness. So it really is just a situation where, like, the elites in Washington, D.C., the kind of people that read the Atlantic, the kind of people that write for the Atlantic, literally just couldn't handle the fact that a good portion of the country that didn't identify with them and their particular political priorities was rejecting them and doing so quite dramatically at the ballot box. So that just caused them to go even harder. You know, they thought maybe if they just lectured more people and wrote, you know, more emphatic essays about how bad Red America was, then, you know, that would surely win them over. And clearly it hasn't.
Mark Hemingway is our guest. He's senior writer for Real Clear Investigations and author of a recent column for The Federalist titled "The Atlantic is Hemorrhaging Money Post-Trump." So what has changed from its previous success to its financial blood loss? And we'll talk about whether or not it might fold up after all. Stay tuned. Thanks to our beloved on-demand listeners, Issues Etc. continues to rank among the top podcasts in religion and spirituality. You can help us climb the charts by subscribing, rating, and reviewing Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit the subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc. Help us cast ChristNet on the internet. Subscribe, rate, and review Issues Etc. today.
Truth, freedom, and vocation are the pillars of a Concordia University Chicago education. Through them, we form our students for lives of influence and service for the common good. This is the education American society needs right now. I'm Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia Chicago, and I invite you to visit us to discover what it means for truth, freedom, and vocation to become the pillars of your future. Learn more at cuchicago.edu.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
We confess that the church is one holy, Catholic, and apostolic, and yet, as we look at the church here in 2021, it hardly seems one holy, Catholic, apostolic church. How do we come to grips with this reality? Is the church one? How is she united? How do we look to her head, Jesus Christ? Well, this question and many others are discussed in the June-July issue of the Lutheran Witness. It's all about the church. To order your copy, visit cph.org/witness and visit our website, witness.lcms.org, to learn more. The Lutheran Witness, helping you look at the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Confessional Lutherans are invited to rent a 4-bedroom, 3-bathroom Table Rock lakefront home in the Ozarks. Table Rock Lake is a premier lake in the heart of the Ozarks for boating, water sports, and fishing. This log cabin-style rental sleeps 12 and is 30 minutes from Branson and 20 minutes from Silver Dollar City. Learn more by calling Swanson Estates, 713-855-2681. Be sure to mention Issues Etc., 713-855-2681.
We're discussing financial struggles and prestige publishing, specifically The Atlantic, with journalist Mark Hemingway of Real Clear Investigations. I'm Todd Wilkin, your link to Issues Etc. You can meet and hear Mark and his wife, Molly Hemingway, at the 2021 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Making the Case begins 10 days from today, Friday, July 23rd, at Concordia University, Chicago. Registration is $150 and includes 3 meals. Affordable lodging options are available, including on-campus dorms. Find out more and register at issuesetc.org or give us a call, 618-223-8385. Making the Case Friday, July 23rd and Saturday, July 24th at Concordia University, Chicago. Mark, the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, Jeffrey Goldberg, is publicly saying he thinks everything's going to be okay, but privately he's being reported that he is worried that the magazine's owner you mentioned before, the widow of Steve Jobs, will pull the plug if things don't improve. You've actually seen this happen more than once in your career. What do you think?
Yeah, I have. I've worked for two different magazines that both had wealthy patrons basically keeping things afloat. That in one case, one of the wealthy patrons actually lost all his money in the tech crash in the early 2000s. And then in the second case, it really was a situation here where the wealthy billionaire that owned the publication decided he didn't like the direction the publication was going in and pulled the plug on it. That can happen when you are dependent on, one wealthy person to basically, keep your publication afloat. I mean, it's not an entirely unusual arrangement in the world of sort of political magazines. But again, it's kind of unusual, like I said, because what The Atlantic did is they took a sort of, general interest prestige magazine that we've sort of discussed, which has, historically been kind of a winning business model insofar as it went out of its way to, leverage its brand to appeal to a large audience of people. And then they've in recent years tried to convert it over to an explicitly, left-wing political magazine, essentially, which is political magazines have always been relatively small circulation, and they have always been, magazines that generally required some kind of external funding to support. So it's really strange that they would have made this decision without understanding the consequences of what they were doing sort of financially. But, I don't know. I mean, Jeffrey Goldberg, who's been editing The Atlantic for several years now, like we've discussed earlier, I mean, I honestly think he's Trump deranged. I mean, he was one of the guys that was responsible for that story last summer about how Trump allegedly called dead American soldiers suckers and losers. His story was entirely anonymously sourced, and 20-something Trump officials went on record denying it and saying it didn't happen. And that's the kind of thing that's been going on at The Atlantic. I mean, there's just no way around it. I mean, that's just, poor quality journalism, and they have been engaged in that kind of, political point scoring rather than, trying to do probing and complex analysis of stuff. Never mind that there was a time 20 years ago when The Atlantic used to regularly have conservative columnists and things like that. Obviously they were still sort of tilting to the left like most major media, but conservatives weren't unwelcome in their pages. And now it's just, off the charts. I mean, they're deranged.
So how do the troubles at The Atlantic fit into the context of the larger decline of trust in the media?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, a lot of, if you're a media property, I mean, a lot of what goes into what you do is this sort of, brand identity. For a long time, when people thought of the New York Times or the Washington Post, I mean, they really did think of high quality journalism simply because the papers actually really cared about their reputation. They didn't care about affecting politics so much as they cared about having this reputation for printing the facts and, getting the stories, right, maybe even getting the stories, first even. But none of that mattered if people didn't, you know, see your name and have some sort of, you know, reverence attached to it. Like, you know, these were serious people doing a serious job that was important to democracy in terms of getting voters the information that they needed. And in general, the entire media industry and, you know, most of the specific big media brands under that umbrella have seen a massive erosion of trust in the last, it's been declining for, you know, probably decades, but in the last 4 or 5 years, the Trump era in particular, it's just been absolutely enormous. And I don't think anybody's begun to reckon with the consequences of that in terms of, you know, where the publishing industry is headed. And it was kind of ironic because Trump was basically keeping the news industry afloat in a lot of ways. You know, they've been hammered by, you know, the internet attacking their business model and nobody wanted to pay for news. And then all of a sudden this, you know, crazy guy comes along and, you know, they convince a substantial, you know, section of the reading public that, you know, they have to, you know, get more informed to oppose this, you know, fascist orange man that's taken over the presidency. But, you know, that was only going to last as long as Trump was in office. And, you know, now it's kind of like they're adrift. Like, now what? You know, what's the big boogeyman that's going to scare people back into reading the news again? And this is true of, you know, all media properties. I mean, TV news viewership is just, you know, fallen through a hole since Trump left office as well. And if they don't come up with an actual business model that, you know, is a long-term sustainable business model that attracts large numbers of eyeballs by providing, you know, information that appeals to a large swath of information and analysis that appeals to a large swath of people, not just partisans, and is high quality and is, you know, sort of, you know, probing analysis, then I don't see how they sustain this. I mean, you know, there isn't a market for telling, you know, a bunch of left-wing Democrats what they want to hear.
Finally, with about a minute here, at the end of 2020, the New York Times claimed 7 million subscribers and more revenue from online subscriptions than from print subscriptions for the first time since they went online. Other than the size, how do we account for the New York Times gains and the Atlantic's losses?
Well, like I said, that was also a function of the Trump era. I mean, there was this huge push, you know, after years of declining revenue of all of a sudden on the left about supporting journalism because it was journalists that were going to hold Donald Trump and these crazy, you know, right-wing administration accountable. The reality was that they were responsible for a lot of, you know, huge journalistic errors. I mean, the whole Trump-Russia collusion story, which the New York Times won Pulitzers for reporting on in ways that are embarrassing in light of the facts that we now know about, you know, most of those accusations not being true. And they these publishing, you know, these prestige publications really leaned into that because, again, like I said, for, you know, a long time there, they've been sort of seeing the writing on the wall with, you know, the internet coming for their revenue. And so they, you know, eagerly chased this, like, you know, active minority of people that were willing to subscribe to their magazine or their newspaper, provided it told them the kind of political news that they were interested in, what they wanted to hear. But, you know, if you're the New York Times or the Atlantic, you don't, you know, that's been around for 100 and something years, you don't sustain that kind of, you know, huge, you know, brand identity and all the revenue that comes with it by being a niche publication that only appeals to a small segment of the American public. You require, you know, multi-million dollar budgets to do the kind of in-depth, you know, international reporting and whatever, you know, to pay the big name writers at the Atlantic or whatever it is. And the revenue just isn't going to come in again if you've turned into a publication that basically publishes, you know, essays and columns that only appeal to not even like Democrats, but I mean like the most extreme 20% of Democrats in terms of, you know, how far left they've gone.
Mark Hemingway is senior writer for Real Clear Investigations. He's author of a recent column for The Federalist titled "The Atlantic is Hemorrhaging Money Post-Trump." You can read it at issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Mark, thanks.
Thank you.
In hour two, we will be back in the Book of Proverbs in Proverbs 28 with Pastor Jonathan Fisk of The Mad Christian. And we'll talk about a recent column in the American Bar Association Journal on mothers and the workplace with Joy Pullman.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.